Coach, there's a news story out there. There's a news story out there that rich people got some sort of an email notification of the terrorist threat against the New York subway before poor people did. Okay? They're making a big deal out of it. Let me see if I can find it on Drudge Report here. Let's see. There's a guy strangling a goose. That's a pretty impressive picture. It's something about bird flu. So he's got this goose, and he's just wringing its neck. You can, email agency. Who tipped off the big shots? Okay, now here's the story, and it says the Homeland Security Department launched internal probes yesterday into whether its officials tipped off friends and relatives to a possible subway terror plot days before average New Yorkers were alerted. So the real gripe here is that it seems that some wealthy...
You go on with your rhetoric, Bortz, because it's clear where you were headed once again and how you were going to justify one set of human beings being placed above another, because those of you who fit within the order, bow down to the order, believe in your hierarchical system and all of the colored dynamics that fit within it. So it's quite natural that what you were about to say was going to fit within that paradigm. Well, there's another paradigm that's in existence that says that the color of your politics is something that will leave, at the end of the day, those of you who follow it blind or in internal darkness. At the hands of the slaves. You know what time it is. Slave time. Into 103.3, 101.1 in Santa Cruz with Skid, 107.5 North Carolina, Upstart Radio, LUBER.com, The World, RadioForAll.net, The Universe, and check out the Slave Web, go Slave Revolt Radio, Google Web, find out what time it is. Tonight, we are going to explore the color of whiteness within the construct of the economic order in America and throughout much of the world. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to
what time it is. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight we're going to deal with a segment called The Color of Whiteness. You know, since the construction of whiteness, those who have pledged allegiance to this social construct have tried to construct other peoples of the world and its history through that lens. Tonight on Slave, we're going to view some of these issues of race and class, not in the shadow of the white manifest destiny formation, but through the lens of people who wish to carve out our own destiny and check out and explore how this social construct is also based within an economic order for control. Tim Wise, who is basically a race traitor to the concept of whiteness in America, goes into some of these issues that we're about to explore. So let's first check out what Tim has to say. You can check out this anti-racist activist on his website that he has called timwise.org. But let's check out some of his comments on the concept of black versus white dependency, something that we often hear being thrown out concerning black people about black so-called dependency. So check this.
I get a lot of emails from people, and it's people usually yelling at me saying, you know, black people are just looking for a handout, you know, whether it's affirmative action, whether it's welfare, whether it's reparation. And, you know, I always get these emails from folks saying how dependent black people are, either on government or really more specifically on whites. And for a long time, I had been thinking about the ways in which, you know, if anything, people who are white or called white in this society, you know, if anything, we're the ones have been most dependent on government, to be sure, and also on black people. I mean, whites historically, and not just black people, but the people of color generally, whites historically, from the very time of colonization and conquest and enslavement, have depended on the labor of black and brown people, on the land of black, brown, and red people, on the labor of Chinese coming to build the railroads, Mexicans teaching us how to get gold out of riverbeds and quartz, blacks to do the work in the South that was critical to the growth of the antebellum economy, blacks who ultimately had to join the Civil War effort for the Union in order for the Union to win. It was that infusion of 200,000 or so black military in the Union forces that helped the Union win the Civil War. And really, you can trace it all the way from the time of slavery and conquest even to now, where every year black consumers spend about $500 billion annually with white-owned businesses. And those white-owned businesses primarily employ white people. Their stockholders and their public are primarily white people. Their owners live in white communities. So, in effect, black folks are transferring $500 billion a year, $500 billion annually, to white folks, which is far more than all the so-called welfare programs, all the benefits of affirmative action, all that put together would come nowhere near $500 billion. So, if anything, if anyone is dependent, really, white America and white businesses and white companies and white individuals are more dependent and always have been on black and brown people than they have been on us. And I thought that was something that was important to point out, both for historical accuracy and also to simply put this issue of whether it's reparations or affirmative action in perspective. Whites have received affirmative action, if you will, the beginning of this country, since before this country was a country, whether it was, you know, free land giveaways under the Homestead Act or GI Bill benefits that were given out in a racially restrictive manner, or Federal Housing Administration loans, VA loans, all of these things that really were whites only for the most part that we never thought about as being racial handouts. But in effect, if whites were eligible for these things and people of color weren't, the effect of that is that whites were given a handout, if you will, that they were dependent, and yet we just never think of ourselves that way.
Now, it's interesting some of the stuff that Tim was going into because in many ways it kind of fits within the overall framework and strategy of an elite class that basically invented whiteness in the first place. Now, we don't have time to really go over all the, you know, there's many books like How the Irish Became White, you know, and papers on how the Italians became white and so on and so forth, where many people came to these shores and irradiated their particular ethnic group. But through different phases and periods, you had an elite dominant class throughout the concept of whiteness in a kind of homogenizing way that blurred the racial class lines of them as the elite class to basically co-opt large segments of the poor, working class, indentured servitude, white or ethnic population into not seeing themselves in alignment with other people who were laborers under the hooves of the elite class, but associated more with other people in the elite class that look like them. So within that concept, you have basically a situation where whiteness was invented to maintain the economic elite ruling class monopoly order, which is why unless that is in part challenged, the construct of whiteness and destroyed, the order will continue on in its perpetual way. So you have a situation where, as Tim was pointing out, how black people's consumers spend $500 billion a year in not their communities, but in quote-unquote white communities. And you see other ways where money is transferred out. Let's take how the issue of gentrification has played a role in blurring the class lines and dynamics. When many whites who see themselves quote-unquote as white, when many whites in the 60s saw great massive influxes and earlier of black people into urban areas, it was called what was known and developed was a form of white flight. So many white people fled out into the suburbs and stuff because they didn't want to be around blacks, and because the way the construct is that too many blacks equals deprivation equals loss of property value. These are artificial constructs, meaning, you know, the property value comes down because another group comes in. That's a social order construct with economic incentive and divisional plans at its core, maintained by an elite class. But many whites from that generation could absorb just moving out, even taking their selling their homes at, you know, below market quote unquote cost, because the working class was relatively it was healthier economically, so on and so forth. It was more unionized, etc., etc. Well, now you see many whites in this current generation trying to move back into a lot of urban areas, not because they want to be around black and Latino people, but because basically the working class in general has taken so many hits that the white working class overall does not have the economic mobility and fluidity that it had at one time, you know, a couple of decades ago. So the white working class, through the outsourcing by the ruling elite class, through crushing of unions, massive attacks, the pension fund transfers, the whole gamut, which the working class in general has taken, and of course, so of course, has the white working class. Now, instead of looking at that dynamic and seeing the elite ruling order being the problem, because that's the one who's waging the war on the working class in general. Instead, a layer of the white working class is acting like parasites themselves by coming in not to really integrate into urban neighborhoods, but be part and parcel of the gentrification tactics and stuff. Using their extra little bit of money to buy homes in areas that are above cost and often above what black and Latinos can pay for. I'm talking about working class black and Latinos can pay for. So this makes a shift in the market, and they know that if there's enough whites that come in, that it will really then start raising the property value by artificial means based off of whiteness, and you'll start seeing a transferring out of one group. Rents will start going up by, you know, landlords, etc., etc. So this is the working, the white working class actually sucking the blood off another segment of the working class, the black and brown. Now, and in part is because many of the white working class do not look at the black and brown working class as part of the same class affiliation. So in the same way that historically, through certain dynamics and constructs, the ruling elite class was able to absorb the consciousness of the white workers, the white laborers, into looking at the world in their lens, a white lens, which is an elitist lens, is the same way that this thing is playing out today. And in many ways, the white elite dominant have always used various means of transferring economics out of the black communities post-slavery. And a lot of that has to do with burning down neighborhoods or destroying the business districts. It's no coincidence that, you know, from the Fillmore, you know, to where the business district was destroyed, or New Orleans, where the black business district was destroyed with a freeway running through it, or in West Oakland, where the 7th, on 7th Street, where the business and economic engine of the internally black community was destroyed by the Cypress freeway and other things, or in 1921, in Oklahoma, where the black community had what was called the Black Wall Street, so where it was economically somewhat independent, not of course completely, but it had some autonomy from the overall dominant structures of the order within the nearby white communities. Then you saw basically the bombing and destruction of the community as a whole, thus making the black people within that community completely dependent once again, once the infrastructure has been destroyed, on the larger community. So these aren't accidents, you know. These are just various forms of transferring and controlling the economic fabric of black life, and doing it through various forms, even violent forms. So in that context, the Hurricane Sam that has taken place in New Orleans and the Gulf region, where you see the Old Line family now strategizing for a new vision of New Orleans and trying to take many areas that were once black dominated and transferred into, you know, casinos and other little things like that. That's another transferring out. So once again, since this whole construct of whiteness was invented to maintain the economic elite ruling order, one can see how the construct of whiteness distorts any concept of human cooperation within the confines and structures that it was invented in America. I'm not talking about every single person who calls themselves white. I'm talking about the whole system of it within the dynamics, of course, especially in America. So how it's based in a hierarchical system where many people, working class people who are white, look at the world through this particular lens. So whiteness then in itself becomes an elitist concept designed in design, and it's a parasitic construct designed to exploit its dark subjects and masses throughout the world. Now, next, Tim Wise goes into how, of course, you got your coons who are used to uphold this mantle of whiteness. So let's deal with this and show how this plays itself out. Check it out.
If you look around today, you see an increasing number, it seems, and certainly an increasing prominence of people of color who are sort of out front as conservative spokespersons against affirmative action, for example. So you see people like Larry Elder, whose background as a social scientist is non-existent. The guy is the host of Moral Court on television, for God's sake. He has no background in these issues. But he writes a book like, 10 Things You Can't Say in America, or whatever it's called. He's a black, ultra-conservative, libertarian type, and he basically, opposes affirmative action, opposes any kind of government program for poor people, essentially. And this guy becomes a prominent spokesperson, saying things that, frankly, were he white saying those things, would probably get him in a lot of trouble because folks would sort of realize it was racist. So what I think is interesting is how people like Larry Elder, Ken Hamblin, Clarence Thomas, Shelby Steele, John McWhorter, some of the people who have, and Linda Chavez, among Latinos as well, people of color sort of being put out there. And when I say put out there, I'm not trying to take away from their abilities as writers. Perhaps some of them are fairly flashy. Dinesh D'Souza is a decent writer, for example. But here he is, a person of color saying these things and all these other names I mentioned in ways that white folks really couldn't get away with. If you look at the way, David Duke is looked at, for example, when he says some of the things he says about black intelligence or black culture, people sort of know that it's overtly racist. But you can get a Dinesh D'Souza to say a lot of the very same stuff, and because he's a person of color, it somehow is looked at as being more legitimate because, oh, well, he can't be a racist, he's a person of color himself, which is, of course, silly, because people of color can certainly be racist against their own or other people of color, and are oftentimes. So the point I was trying to make was that it's convenient, to say the least, that these black and brown conservatives and reactionaries are coming to the forefront, because every time I get into an argument with somebody about these kinds of issues, they invariably bring up the fact that Ken Hamblin, Larry Elder, Walter Williams, they throw out the same names. Hey, these people say it, so my argument can't be racist because here's a black person who agrees with me. The irony of that being, when was the last time these people ever cared about what a black person said? But suddenly they find one that agrees with them, and that somehow takes the racial stigma off of the argument. So I think that's a form of dependence. I think we've become dependent on having those kind of people who we can put out there and say, see, our views aren't racist. And that is a dependence, whereas if we had to make those arguments alone, we'd probably have a heck of a lot harder time making them.
What this also exposes is how the dominant element is able to pick and choose what arena of debate and how the debates are framed. Because if one looks at, like, let's say the Jason Blair issue. Jason Blair was this Negro reporter at New York Times. He made up a lot of stories, and of course he was he got busted. He was chastised for it, and many whites then used that to catapult the issue of affirmative action and said, look, do you get these unqualified Negroes in here, and this is what happens. They're affirmative action people, and they're not qualified to do real, decent, honest stories, so they just make up stuff, and this is a result of this whole quota type of system, so on and so forth. So they played the race card to the tilt. But then all of a sudden, when Armstrong Williams, who's a Negro who speaks for the elite order, gets caught red-handed being involved in taking money from the administration to write and speak out favorably for the No Child Left Behind nonsense. He gets $241,000. It's not put in that context. So he's protected from the backlash from the elite element, because they are the ones who, through their lenses of whiteness within the economic construct, pick and choose what issues and how to frame the particular issues. So Williams is going around saying, you know, I made a bad decision, and all of that type of stuff when he was confronted with it. But as you recall, it was never put in the same type of context that the Jason Blair was when he when the issue of his race as a black person, meaning Jason Blair, was brought into the mix, as opposed to Armstrong Williams, who's a Negro, where the racial issue wasn't brought into the mix. And this is also on top of Armstrong Williams admitting that, quote, this happens all the time. There are others. And he was right. There have turned out to be many other people who played within this construct and stuff. So the so once again, the element of not only how racial things are framed, but how the elite order, of course, was not going to allow how the affirmative action, so to speak, of those who are puppet spokespersons for the ruling order was not brought into place. How there's a quota system on that as it fits within the whole corporate orthodoxy. And to further emphasize that, here, of course, is a third person within that paradigm that I'ma bring up, you know, who are all, you know, quote unquote, within the reporter slash journalist mode. Here's Judith Miller, in the face of all of her shameless hypocrisy, on April 28th, 2005, at the Commonwealth Club, outlining the importance of bringing news to people and how important it is in quote-unquote democratic societies. Check this out.
And I think we really have to go back to the founding of our great country and the drafting of our Constitution in 1787 and its ratification a year later. Now, as originally drafted, that document did not contain any protection for the freedom of the press, and it didn't provide any individual protections either. But our founding fathers, a remarkable group of men, quietly and quickly realized the seriousness of this omission, and led by James Madison, they drafted a series of amendments, and these amendments were intended to rectify the omissions in the Constitution. And the first of these, of course, is the reason I'm here, the cornerstone of what I try to do and my fellow journalists try to do all over the country every day, which is to bring news that people need to know, and in the case of my newspaper, without fear or favor, to people who elect the government that has now put us in this situation. The First Amendment declared that Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or of the press. And those 14 crucial words are the equivalent of my constitutional commandments. And they're the spirit in which my colleagues and I think, try and live. And we have been debating them among ourselves, and the Congress has been debating what they mean and how they can best be implemented ever since they were written, which is really why we're here.
Okay, so once again, you have a situation where here this person you know, who aligned herself with Chalabi, who of course was one of the administrators of deceit for the ruling class to help perpetuate this barbaric war against the people of Iraq, and how that all fits in within the particular dynamic of how these issues are framed within this particular society because of the lens that the elite class looks at the world. And that lens is also based within a racial coded construct. So you have a situation where you can see how, like, the process will work. Now, here's a little article about something that recently happened with Judith Miller, where the Secret Service records prompted key Miller testimony. A New York Times reporter, Judith Miller, told the federal grand jury in the CIA leak case that she might have met with Louis Libby on June 23rd, 2003, only after prosecutors showed her Secret Service log that indicated she and Libby had indeed met that day in the executive office building adjacent to the White House, according to attorneys familiar with her testimony. When a prosecutor first questioned Miller during her initial grand jury appearance on September 30th, 2005, sources said she did not bring up the June 23rd meeting in recounting her various contacts with Libby, the chief of staff to Vice President Cheney, pressed by prosecutors who then brought up the specific date of the meeting. Miller testified that she still could not recall the June meeting with Libby, in which she discussed a controversial CIA-sponsored mission to Africa by former Ambassador Joe Wilson, or the fact that his wife, Valerie Plame, worked for the CIA. When a prosecutor presented Miller with copies of the White House complex visitation logs, she said such a meeting was possible. Shortly after her September 30th testimony, Miller discovered her notes from the June 23rd meeting and returned on October 12th for a second round of grand jury testimony. In this second appearance, Miller recounted details from her June 23rd meeting with Libby with the assistance of her notes. Unquote. Now, the reason why I mention this is that the whole Jason Blair also thing case became a thing of morality and the lack thereof. But here, Judith Miller has been lying and, you know, defending an order and so on and so forth, all the way down the line. But it wasn't, it's not racialized and stuff. So it's not just something where people are ostracized on an individual basis within this society. It has racial overtones, and that racial overtones is constructed through a lens of an elite order. So you can see how within the social economic construct, whiteness in America was created as a construct of control. So Judith Miller, and a lot of this thing that evolves around her, you know, the Office of Special Plans basically faked the documents. They forged them. They forged the signature and so on and so forth, you know, but they got the name wrong. And the CIA asked Boy George not to say anything concerning the uranium Niger or Africa connection, because then it was going to be clear that this was an intelligence construct because they got the wrong name. As we all know, Boy George ended up saying anyway. Now, Libby, as you know, it's becoming pretty clear, was the source for Judith Miller. And some of the connection that goes on with it appears in outing Plame was that Plame was in position to uncover the Niger documents, which, you know, would have created a whole nother dynamic, because remember, the Office of Special Plans and, you know, all these little hoodlums, you know, Cheney, Rumsfeld and all of them who created this Office of Special Plans were often conflicting with the CIA, because they didn't like the fact that the CIA wasn't going along and beholden to the lies that they were creating before this war and justification in Iraq. Now, remember, as you recall, neocons and Office of Special Plans cats were thinking of ways to try to hype up the American population's fear about the Iraqi situation to justify the war. And as they've even admitted in some news articles or magazine articles, that the reason why they came up with the weapons of mass destruction is because that's what the American population was biting on. So you have this whole dynamic taking place. And within that whole construct, one also must then go back. Plame is in position to uncover the forgers, her being within the CIA. And then you have Boy George saying that the British government has heard that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. That was his quote. Well, where did the British get that from? Where did their intel get that from? They got it from the Italians. Who did the Italians get it from? They got it from Israel. Now, Rove, Miller, you know, Libby, all of these guys, all connected with the Department of Defense, the DOD, and all of that type of stuff. And that whole scandal that was taking place with AIPAC, where it was clear that Israel was using the DOD and its officials to hand over classified info to the Israeli lobby, who then were turning it over to, once again, the state of Israel, which Libby and all of these people were interconnected with. So in part, Miller's plea, basically to go into prison and protect Libby and try to blur the whole connections, was in part to protect the AIPAC connection. Now, the reason why I mention this is that, once again, you know, the whole aspect of AIPAC, their influence, is all part of the influence of the whole lobbyist system, which is a construct of the hierarchical order by the ruling elite class, which is designed for you to look through the world through a white elite lens, because that's how it was created and fomented. So this involves protecting that whole interest, which is big oil, the big oil interest, the AIPAC interest, and the whole hierarchical construct. So, you know, within the dynamic of their whole grand chessboard strategies and stuff. And within that whole mechanism, one can see that what she was doing essentially was also protecting the ruling elite class. And her ruling elite class is a part of a hierarchical system that is there to maintain the privileges of an elite order that looks that has constructed itself off of a white dominant supremacist lens and construct. So there we go again within that whole process. Now next, here Tim Wise goes into another aspect of how the game is played and how it's often looked at through certain lenses that fits within the confines of an elite order. And this is this deals with Ward Connolly and the affirmative action scam that has blown up. And when I say scam, you'll see what I mean when I break it down. So check this out first.
Connolly is a guy who, you know, stories have been written about this in many different outlets, who received the benefits of affirmative action. Now, he'll argue that he didn't ask for them, but that's sort of beside the point. As a minority contractor involved in housing rehabilitation contracts in the state of California, he received about half of the money that his business made in the years prior to the affirmative action vote in 1996, Proposition 209. About half of the money that he had made had come from contracts that where, frankly, he had received some level of preference as a minority contractor. Now, I, for one, as a supporter of affirmative action, don't have any problem with that at all. I think it's great that Ward Connerly and his business were able to make money doing this kind of work. And frankly, had it not been for affirmative action, folks like Ward Connerly might have been locked out of the networks, and that would be unfair. But the horrible thing is, here you have Connerly, you know, who was put out there as the spokesman, trying to attack the very programs that he benefited from. And it was so blatantly obvious in California when Proposition 209 was first dreamt up, before it had a number, when it was just the California Civil Rights Initiative, so-called. The two spokespeople for it were Glenn Custard and Tom Wood, two white guys, two white academics. They were the spokespeople, and they were the ones who were out there. And within about 6 months, it was pretty obvious to those folks that it just wasn't going to work. If these two white guys were the public face of this proposition, that it was going to be seen as this sort of angry white guy backlash. And so what better to sort of prevent that criticism than by bringing in someone like Ward Connerly to make the argument? And so you never heard from Tom Wood again. You know, Tom Wood was exposed on Dateline, I believe it was, for having lied. He came up with his own story of personal victimization. He had been the victim of reverse discrimination because some black woman had gotten a faculty position that he was more qualified for. Well, Dateline, you know, looked into it and found out that, in fact, this woman was eminently more qualified than he was. She'd written two or three books. He hadn't written anything in 20 years. And once that happened, of course, you know, he could no longer be the public face of the proposition. So he just sort of faded into the background. Nobody heard from him. And Ward Connerly became the spokesperson. And then he, you know, was cut loose on Washington State as well and tried to start the same kind of thing in Florida, although that was sidetracked to some degree so far. So, I mean, I think it just goes to show how really dependent whites are on the cover, if you will, that black and brown conservatives can provide for us. When we want to say something but we don't want to seem racist, we just get a brown face to say it, and then we somehow feel better.
And also, it's much deeper than that, because in many ways, this issue of affirmative action in reality was a question of access. And let me break down how the working class was played and how white progressives and stuff basically got pimped in the whole process because of how they identify with whiteness. You had a situation where when the issue, as I said, this has always been about access. Over the last 20 years in California, there's basically been about 20 plus prisons built to one new university. At the same time, California and the population in the country has grown incredibly. And you can see that there's been a great expansion on high schools and grade schools, but there hasn't been an expansion on the universities. Now, black people have always known that black people have always been qualified in all spectrums of society. One of the key issues is in a hierarchical system, we often have not been having the luxury of having access. But the way it was framed was that unqualified black people are getting into these universities through affirmative action. And you had many progressives either play one or two type of dynamics. That yes, we know they may or probably are unqualified, but you know, because of past discrimination, you know, maybe there should be some access. But you know, maybe we should make it more of an economic issue, because if a black person is upper middle class and you have a white person who's poor or moderate working class, it's unfair for that black person to have that advantage. Now, never mind the fact that, black communities are often zip coded, and schools like a Burlingame High in the mid-peninsula, they'll get certain advantages and points as opposed to other schools in like a 94607 area code in Oakland, just by being in that particular zip code, which gives one quote-unquote advantages to getting into universities. But once again, the overall thing was a class issue, because what the rulers were saying is that we're limiting your access to higher education because the overall class attack is saying that there isn't much future for the working class in America because we're outsourcing your jobs, we're crushing them down, etc., etc. So what recently happened just the past year? You had hundreds of black students who had 4.0 grade point averages and very high SATs who couldn't get into the University of Berkeley. And you had hundreds of white students with high SATs and 4.0 grade point averages that couldn't get in to the university. And Arnold told all of them to go to a junior college. So the issue wasn't qualification, it was access. But since many white working class people looked at the issue as through the white dominant elitist order lenses of whiteness, they missed the whole class dynamic that the limitation on people's access to higher education, just like many other things that affirmative action tries to address, is the issue of class access and the dynamic and social construct and economic construct that has overall. They're waging war on the working class. And by crushing affirmative action, that's just another part of it, especially within the context of that they're building so many prisons. So basically, what they're saying is that the working class, well, you will have access to the prisons, and we're willing to spend money to that towards that, but we're not willing to spend money towards expanding access into college in California. So it's clear that that's a class attack on the whole working class overall, which is why the issue of the attacks on, by us, the prison industrial complex and its formation is interconnected to university access, workplace access, etc., because it's a class dynamic attack by the ruling order. So one can see how this dynamic was set off kilter by many white progressives because they didn't look at it as an issue of access and an issue of a class attack by a ruling elite order that's playing the dynamic of race themselves through white lenses for their economic control. So in the same way that Miller, or a similar way, that Miller, Judith Miller, was protecting white privilege, which is part of the imperial structure, which is part of a white elite privilege structure, one can see that as long as one identifies themselves with whiteness, they're protecting the order. Because as we've gone over earlier, whiteness is a elitist economic construct. It was designed by a ruling elite class to maintain its hegemony and dominance over the masses of people. That's why it was constructed. So whiteness was interconnected to the economic fabric of this society and throughout the world. So once again, whiteness was created as a construct of control. Now next, Tim Wise goes into how the image of welfare changed. And when the image of people on welfare changed, so did its support from many working class people. Check it out.
I think that, you know, there have been a number of books and scholarly articles about the way that poor people are portrayed, for example, the way that welfare recipients are portrayed. A really good book, Martin Gillen's book, Why Americans Hate Welfare, was an excellent book because it talks about the ways in which in the last 20 years the the media, particularly mainstream broadcast media, and even print media to a degree, have consistently overrepresented blacks and Latinos in stories about the poor, stories about welfare recipients. If you go back to the 1960s, from about the mid-60s to the early 70s, it was whites who were mostly portrayed as poor folks, and it was whites who were mostly portrayed as recipients of various government aid programs, and interestingly enough, the support level for those programs was much higher. And then, as the face of the welfare recipient changed, particularly in the public media, not so much in reality, the face had didn't really change numerically. Whites were still, you know, more of the welfare recipients, but the public image that was put out by the media changed, and all of a sudden you began to see a lot of black faces, and then you saw the support levels drop. And Gillens does a very good job of pointing out that when you control for a whole number of factors that affect public perception of things like welfare, that really one of the primary determiners for whether or not someone is going to be supportive of government income support or so-called welfare programs is the degree to which they perceive those programs as benefiting mostly minorities. And if they perceive those programs as being mostly about helping black and brown people, they are far less likely to support those things than they would be if they believe those programs to be mostly about white people. And he shows this very consistently in this book. So I think that's one example of how the notion of black dependence or minority dependence has been perpetuated over the years. And certainly, I'm afraid that with the reparations debate sort of coming to the forefront now, that the media will probably, as is usually the case, not do a particularly good job explaining what that is about. And, you know, a recent story on reparations that 2020 did was sort of a perfect example of this. You know, they spent a very small amount of time actually discussing the arguments that the primary movers and shakers in the reparations movement are making, people like Randall Robinson. And instead, you know, they focused a good 5 minutes of their show on this one elderly black guy who goes around the country essentially ripping black people off by saying, you know, if you pay me $50, I'll file your reparations claim for you and you'll get a check for $50,000 in the mail. And he goes around just like a lot of ministers and just like a lot of, you know, snake oil salesmen, essentially ripping off black people. And that's certainly a story, but to put that in the context of this reparations discussion is to, you know, number one, skew that discussion towards this side issue of this one individual black guy who happens to be a con man, it seems. And also it gives the impression of, aha, see, here's a black guy who's preying on his own people, and these black folks are so dependent on the idea of getting a government check that they'll fork over their money to this guy. And it just sort of, it reinforces the handout mentality that a lot of white folks have vis-a-vis black people, the idea that that's all they're looking for. And I think the media is going to have to really do a better job of covering these issues. And of course, you know, the idea of white dependence on black people is just never discussed. I mean, these things about, you know, if you go back even historically, white dependence on slave labor is sort of intuitively understood, but I don't think we understand it, it's not taught very clearly in the history books, just how important that slave labor was to the creation of the economy and the creation of white wealth. We certainly don't talk much in our history books in high schools about the dependence on Asian labor, particularly Chinese labor, to build the railroads. We certainly don't learn about the importance of Indian people teaching white folks, frankly, how to farm, because we didn't know how to do it. And if it hadn't been for them teaching us those skills, we would have starved to death in the colonies in the 1620s. You know, it's just not discussed because it detracts from the myth of American heroism, you know, American accomplishment, this idea that these brave, noble, God-fearing people came to this land and built something out of nothing, when in fact, you know, a lot of people who were frankly criminals got on a boat, came from Europe, didn't know how to do anything when they got here, were starving to death, took other people's land, forced other people to work for them, and had it not been for those people of color essentially bailing us out, we would have died. We would have died off, and the experiment known as America probably would never have happened at all.
Now, some of the other aspects of how this is looked at in through certain racialized lenses of whiteness is that, you know, corporate welfare is a form of white welfare, because in part it was developed by an elite order that constructed the concept of whiteness, which was, of course, part and parcel a concept developed for privilege and special interest and specialized access and domination. Now, you also have the situation where we seem like laws be used in racialized terms in ways intentionally by an elite class, but it was really to protect their particular elite interests. So if you look at some of the issues concerning marijuana, like in the 30s, hemp is a product that makes very good quality paper, nylon, and other things. And it grows real fast. It's very durable. And the paper industry and the nylon industry saw this product as a threat. Those captains of industry wanted to protect their interests, who were in the paper and the nylon, so on and so forth. And they did not want this other product to get a foothold into the market, in the same way that the petroleum industry does not want solar power, wind power, to get a strong foothold in the market. So in part, what they did, though, was to play their racial card through their white privilege construct. They started to associate marijuana with the jazz musicians, and that by de facto associating it with black culture meant, through white lenses, the deviant culture, the obscene culture, the immoral culture. Now, they did this to protect their interests, knowing that by playing the race card and how much of the population looks at the black experience in through white lenses, that this is the way to make this product illegal. Now, they weren't doing it to because of any real concern about people using marijuana outside of, you know, some little, you know, hocus pocus religious type fanatics that you always have running around, of course, even today, or some moralist quote unquote types, you know, Pat Robinson or whatever. But it was really an institutional maneuver to control a particular market. So this was done by many segments of population, or the this was done by an elite segment of the population for their own economic benefit and to maintain their monopolized control over particular products. And they used their race card techniques and the fact that many people look through the lenses of whiteness as they constructed it to their advantage. Now, another thing has taken place concerning this welfare aspect. You had a situation where, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, when there were strikes by workers, some of them had become successful. And at a certain point, some of the corporations were looking at how were these workers winning? How were they staying out long on strikes and still being able to maintain themselves economically, you know, pay their house notes, so on and so forth, and defeat us? Was it just that the unions were that strong? And what they saw was that in some of these cases, the workers were getting welfare benefits while they were out on strikes. So for the ruling class, this was like, wait a minute now. They're using the welfare as an advantage to defeat us in strikes in this class oppositional dynamic. So this was also part of the reason why the apparatus of the corporate state started to thrust in the images of black people being on welfare so that they could dismantle that apparatus, not so much just because they, you know, thought they were going to quote unquote save money, because as we all know, you know, the amount of money that is spent on welfare for people throughout the country is really a drop in the bucket. But they wanted to dismantle it, and they have wanted to dismantle it as part of a class attack on the overall strength of the working class as a whole, especially as it uses it as an advantage to stay afloat in this hierarchical system. And the way that they were, now they couldn't just come out and say that. So they played the race card and counted on the fact that large segments of the population within this society would look at the world through a white racialized lens and then frown upon welfare, even though they're cutting their own throats. Because once again, it was access to money and a safety net within this society while you're waging class warfare against the state apparatus. Now, in the same way that was still an access issue, is the same way that affirmative action is. But since much of the population is hypnotized into their own whiteness through the lenses of a white ruling order that constructed whiteness, well then you can see how large segments of the white working class is basically slitting their own throat and their own interests. Because as I've said before, whiteness was invented to maintain the economic elite ruling class monopoly order. So within that construct, one can see how this dynamic has played itself out. Now next, Tim Wise goes into the issue of racial profiling. So let's check this out.
You know, it is probably the number one concern, or number two or three concern, of just about every person of color that I meet around the country. And that doesn't matter whether they're poor, whether they're middle class, whether they're working class, or whether they're quite affluent. In fact, to some degree, the more affluent a person of color is, the more important the racial profiling issue becomes, because it's oftentimes more affluent Black and Latino folks who are driving nice cars, for example, or dressed very nicely, and have a little bit of money, who are the most suspected. You know, poor people of color are obviously suspected anywhere they go, and so it's really hard to tell what level of profiling among the poor is racial and what level is economic or what level is a combination. But among the more affluent or the middle class, it's pretty obvious. You know, if you're a middle class professional Black or Latino or Asian male, for example, and you're stopped disproportionately and never ticketed, you know, just stopped and asked questions by a patrolman and then let go. And this happens to you over and over and over again. There's something going on. And I hear those stories everywhere I go. I hear them certainly in the Pacific Northwest. I hear them in the South. I hear them in the Midwest. I hear them in the Northeast. There's nowhere that I travel where I don't hear about it. And when I write articles about it, I get emails, obviously, and letters and phone calls, frankly, from people all around the country who are talking about their own experiences, many of them dealing with police, many of them dealing with store clerks, you know, many of them dealing with teachers and principals in schools who are clearly disproportionately sort of holding them out for punishment and or searches or suspicion. It goes on at every level of our institutional life, and yet there's a significant number of people who still refuse, particularly in the white community, who refuse to believe that profiling happens, or who try and justify it by saying, well, you know, the Black crime rate really is higher, so therefore, you know, this is an okay practice. But the reality is, you know, racial profiling is almost always done with regard to drug offenses. I mean, that is why police departments develop profiles. They don't really stop, you know, people randomly hoping that they're going to find the person that knocked over the liquor store the night before. They have other ways of catching armed robbers. They typically are looking for drugs. That's what most of these stop and frisk and search things in New York City or most other places are about. And the reality is 76% of all drug users in this country are white people, and that whites at every age level are equally or even more likely to use illegal drugs than Blacks are, particularly amongst young kids, like high school kids, high school seniors, for example. White seniors are far more likely to use every category of drug than black seniors. So if profiling and stop and search and frisks and car searches and things like that are primarily about drugs, and if whites are the ones who are doing most of the drugs and are actually more likely to do them, then not only is the racial profiling against black and Latino kids and adults racist, it's also dumb policy. And the point that I think needs to be made is that this kind of thing doesn't have anything to do with crime fighting. It doesn't reduce the amount of drug use. It doesn't reduce the amount of drug trafficking. The Customs Bureau, for example, 2 years ago was caught having racially profiled black women, particularly coming through customs checkpoints at international airports. And they found that black women were 9 times more likely than white women to be stopped and searched for drugs, but that white women were actually twice as likely to actually have drugs on them. Now, you know, this really raises two questions. I mean, number one, the racism of it, obviously, but then number two is just the stupidity of it. If white women are twice as likely to be found with drugs on them when you actually stop them, but you stop black women 9 times more often, then by definition, you're letting thousands of white women who you know good and well, based on your previous encounters, are going to have drugs on them, just sort of walk right through, and you're not stopping and searching them. So it's clearly racist. It's not good policy. It has nothing to do with crime control. It has nothing to do with law enforcement. It has everything to do with stereotypes, with preconceived notions, and frankly, with racism.
Well, in essence, racial profiling is just a tool of oppression. And part of that oppression is a limited of access and a control of the segment of the population. And by weakening that segment of the population, you're weakening the whole segment of the labor class population. We've seen a racial profiling through the corporate structure, which has always played itself out. It is always profiled. Jim Crowism is a form of racial profiling. Slavery was a form of racial profiling. What Denny's Restaurant was doing was a form of racial profiling. And here you have Denny's Restaurant all over the country that was getting caught racial profiling black people in San Jose, black students that wanted to go and eat some of their raggedy food were told they would have to pay a cover charge. A black cop and his family were not allowed admission. Some silly Negroes who were Secret Service servicemen, you know, protecting the raggedy president, weren't even allowed in to eat after the white Secret Service men were. A group of blacks in another area who were coming up to the door saw the Denny's workers come and lock the doors and stuff. Now, this was happening all over the country. They ended up making some big settlement and all of that type of stuff. People have heard me mention this in my commentary, the Klan Museum coming to a town near you. But my whole point is that while this was constructed by the corporate orthodoxy that is, as I said before, has mixed the construct of whiteness as an economic tool of control and division, it was basically white workers who were carrying this out. It was, you know, so here you have white workers who, you know, what are you making, a dime an hour working for Denny's? Yet they are also looking through the lens of the elite order, which is not in basically is exasperating the whole dynamic and the whole collusion of that segment of the population and the destructiveness of it. Now, we've also seen how the profiling works, where even whites who have felony records yet have the same type of educational and work experience as blacks without felony workers have an incredibly higher percentage of being called back for interviews and what have you on jobs than their black counterparts from equal background but without felony records. This is a form of racial of profiling, but this also ties in within the whole state and the police state power apparatus, which is in part grown off of the back of black oppression and white hierarchical privatized power. Now, what I mean by that is we can see that in, let's say, we can see that type of situation in the sharp dynamics that are taking place in New Orleans, for instance. Here, you have the old line white elite families and stuff. They're doing what? They're using mercenaries in New Orleans to control the overall population. They're targeting black people especially. They're targeting the Ninth Ward and other communities because they want to envision another New Orleans. But what they've done to ramp this up is that they've ramped up the power of the state police apparatus with the mercenaries and martial law and all of that. Now, so the oppression of black people is tied in to the growing power of the state and police apparatus. This was intentionally intensified by the propaganda by the corporate media structure, which propagandized black barbarity and depravity, which you really couldn't see any difference between what the corporate media was reporting and what was being garbled out of the behind of David Duke. It was basically the same type of rhetoric. But what this did was allow the state apparatus to put more power within to the state apparatus of the police and other mercenary enforcement institutions that then helps protect and maintain and grow the power of the elite hierarchical system. So once again, you can see how black oppression helps foment the power of the state, helps elevate the power of the police apparatus, crushing the very rights of our lives right before our eyes, regardless of what you look like within the working class sector. Now, to go on about this racial profiling aspect, you know, many people have also heard me do the commentary, not commentary, my segment called Notes from a Draptomania. And that actually comes, there's a real name called Draptomania, which was basically a fictionalized psychiatric disorder. In other words, it was created by a white man named Dr. Samuel Cartwright. He was a specialist at the University of Louisiana. And he discovered a quote-unquote new disease, and it was called Draptomania. And this was the disease for black people who ran away from slavery. And he came up with another concept of a psychiatric disorder called Dyceum Aspiria, which were for black people who fought against their slave masters and so on and so forth. So in other words, there was some kind of something biologically wrong with black people who resisted against the horrors of chattel slavery. Now this, of course, is looking at the world through a white lens constructed by a white orthodoxy in a form of racial profiling. Now next, let's go in, as I said before, the other aspect of racial profile in the game. And this, of course, was by the legendary corporation called Texaco. The Texaco case exposed racial profiling in favor of whites, the white ruling order, and segments of the white working class who play along with the system at the demise of blacks. Now, this was a lot of this conversation and some of the clips you will hear was recorded by a former employee at Texaco, but you'll see as the thing is commentated on.
Of the 873 executives who earn more than $106,000 a year, only six are black. A discrimination case exploded in a national controversy on November 4th. When court documents from the lawsuit reveal that a laid-off finance manager turned over a secret tape he recorded at corporate headquarters in August 1994. On the tape, executives seemed to belittle minority employees. Three of the participants, then-treasurer Robert Ulrich, David Keogh, a senior assistant treasurer, and Richard Lundwall, a senior personnel coordinator who recorded the meeting. Today's conversations, as shown on ABC's Good Morning America, were released by Plex lawyers after being enhanced for sound quality. African American employees were referred to as black jelly beans. There were also what appeared to be racist remarks about Texaco employees who celebrate Kwanzaa, an African American holiday. There were more comments which have reportedly led to a criminal investigation by the FBI of obstruction of justice. The executives are heard making what seems to be plans to destroy evidence in the lawsuit. Texaco responded by cutting off the benefits of two of the executives who are now retired. Two other executives still with the company have been suspended with pay.
Okay, so once again, you see how this particular dynamic plays itself out within the confines of the corporate structure. Now, Texaco ended up paying $176 million to the like 41 defendants and stuff. They paid like $115 million in damages immediately and did some pay raises and all of that type of stuff. But you know, the game still goes on and on and on. I mean, there's cases like this all the time. And this one white worker who turned over this stuff was only after, like, they mentioned that he got laid off. So once again, you have an hierarchical structure, an elite corporate structure that sets up these things just like at Denny's. But many of the white workers were the ones who were carrying out these policies. There was what was called a black book, which basically glass-ceilinged black workers into the lowest rungs of the workforce, economically, socially, politically, regardless of their talent and stuff. So once again, you can see how whiteness within the construct of the market order maintains privilege for white workers, as well as hold up the whole elite economic order on the backs of, in part, black people. But the cost, it does it for, it holds it on the backs of all people, but especially on black people. And but the cost for white workers who look through that lens of whiteness and view the world in that way, the cost for them is basically to lose one's soul, or at least sell it to the devil, the orthodoxy. So once again, you can see the dynamics of how whiteness was created by the order as a construct of control, and how it distorts one's vision, amongst other things, and how it's a ruthless game. And in part also, when people believe in whiteness within that construct, you are in part believing in an elitist order and in a hierarchical system with the various peoples of the world on the the end of the lynch rope. Now here Tim Wise talks about some of the Hurricane Sam issues and perceptions that took place in New Orleans. So let's see how Wise deals with some of this, and then let's take it from there. Check it.
The people of color always think that the notion of national unity was nonsense, but it seemed that much of the white community did not get it, and if we are to judge by the shocked reaction of an awful lot of white folks in the wake of Katrina, in terms of white surprise at the fact that poor folks of color were being left behind in the streets of New Orleans, we would have to suggest that much of white America was continuing to live in that la-la land that presumed that we indeed were one nation, united in purpose and cause. have editorialists like David Brook, a conservative columnist for the New York Times, who wrote an editorial just a few days after the inundation of New Orleans when the 17th Street Canal broke and the levees broke in New Orleans, in which he expressed his surprise and his indignation at the fact that poor folks of color had been left to essentially die in the streets of New Orleans. And if you read his pieces around that time, back at the beginning of September, you see language like, the confidence of the American public has been shaken to the core. But of course, the only kind of person who could assume that the confidence of the American public had been shaken as a result of Katrina would be someone like David Brooks, or for that matter, the white American public more broadly, that has the luxury of somehow believing that the system was fair for people of color. The idea that they would be left behind by the tens of thousands, particularly low-income folks of color, really isn't all that shocking. And it really leads us to ask the question that we should have been asking anyway, which is, what planet and what country have many of us in the white community been living on? Katrina may have blown back the curtain on a system of racial and economic oppression, but let us be very clear in suggesting that that system of racial and economic oppression had existed long before that hurricane struck, and it had been almost exclusively outside the glare of the cameras and the reporters that lined Canal Street at the end of August and the beginning of September 2005. And what I would say is that it wasn't at all surprising to see 110 to 120,000 persons left behind due to the combination of incompetence and neglect on the part of local, state, and federal government officials. In fact, that's quite to be expected in a country where the mentality of every man or woman for themselves is really sort of the operative, dominating ideology in our country. The notion of rugged individualism is the kind of ideology that we have. And when you have that mentality that says that it's every man or woman for himself, we ought not be surprised when the government at all levels does not take the steps necessary to protect the weakest members of the society in terms of economics and the most exploited and oppressed members of the community in terms of race. And so I think if we're going to have a progressive or a radical analysis of Katrina, we have to start off by rejecting liberal argumentation that we are hearing from many within the Democratic Party, which suggests that somehow this was an example of a system failure. This was somehow the system breaking down. This was not, in fact, a system failure. It was the system operating exactly as it's intended to operate. You ought not be surprised to find that that system regularly lets down the poorest, regularly lets down working class people, regularly lets down racially and nationally oppressed groups. If a small nation like Cuba is able to protect its people from a Category 5 storm, it seems preposterous to assume that the wealthiest nation on the face of the earth would not be capable of protecting tens of thousands of its citizens from a Category 4 storm, and really, in the case of New Orleans, not even a direct hit from that storm, because it was really the surge and the breaking of the levees, not the hurricane itself, which did so much of the damage. So I think we have to begin with the premise that what we saw happen in New Orleans was not a system failure. It was the system operating as it was basically set up to do. Those with the means to escape can escape. Those without the means to escape are left to fend for themselves. And that's really not all that different from what happens on a normal day in this country. Leaving people behind is what we do in the United States, particularly if they are poor, particularly if they are folks of color. Of course, as with everything else that concerns race in America, white America refused by and large to believe that. And so if you look at the polls and the survey data that have been taken in the last 4 or 5 weeks, you'll find that, of course, between 70 and 80% at least of white Americans are convinced that race and class, neither one, had really anything to do with the inadequate response to the tragedy in New Orleans. And you will find the same numbers between 70 and 80% of African Americans saying that, of course, race and class had something to do with it. This difference in white and black perceptions is really no different than what you would see in any other comparison of racial attitudes on any other subject or subtopic. Whites, according to all the available survey data taken for 20 years, never seem to think that racism is a real problem, never seem to think that it continues to be a significant and salient issue for people of color. So the fact that in the wake of Katrina, black folks would see it one way, white folks would see it another way, is just, again, standard operating procedure. And so it really leaves it to us, those of us who talk about issues of race and class oppression, to provide this analysis. And I think we have to start off with the recognition that the system in which we live is one that has been set up to fail certain people, that has been set up to cater to the needs of some and to deprioritize the interests and the needs and the lives of others. This argument is really quite different from what the liberal left has been saying. Almost all of it has been seeking to individualize the blame for what we saw in the streets of New Orleans and to some extent in the greater Gulf Coast region. And so, for example, what we have had is liberal interest groups and journalists who have tried to make this into an issue of George W. Bush, or perhaps into an issue of FEMA, morph into an issue of the GOP, the Republican Party more broadly, or into a discussion about Halliburton and the handful of corporations who are going to profit handsomely from the rebuilding and the restructuring of New Orleans. And while all of those points may indeed have a certain degree of validity, I think it's important for those of us on the left try to move this discussion away from individualized blame and individualized analysis toward a more systemic and institutional focus. In the United States, we do tend to individualize discussions of race to issues of interpersonal bigotry and bias. And so if we do not see overt institutional bigotry and bias, those of us, particularly who are white, oftentimes then respond by saying that racism, for example, had nothing to do with what we're actually observing. On the other hand, folks of color, we're used to looking at the issue of racism through the lens of impact and through the lens of the effect, not so much the intent, and look at the same set of facts and know exactly how it feels and know exactly who it was that paid the price and who it was that bore the consequences. And to folks of color, it is the impact that makes something racist, not so much the intent. And as long as we go along with the liberal perspective, which is that George W. Bush and his administration and Dick Cheney and Mike Brown, the former head of FEMA until recently, is to blame, we're not going to be looking at this larger system. And I think that that's really what we ought to be doing on the left. So that's what I would like to do.
All right. So once again, you see a situation the elite order talks about national unity, and many people buy into that and also regurgitate it out. That basically is to divide the working class in a sense, because it's double talk. Because we know that there's no real national unity because you have a ruling class. But if you have segments that are automatically out of the guise of whatever, or different things, align themselves with national unity that's dictated out by a ruling order, they're not going to identify quite naturally with large segments of the people within their own labor class. So basically, you can see once again that these terms and this construction of whiteness is, as it's used in these various ways, is basically created as a class tool by the ruling class for divisional purposes and, as I said before, the aspect of control by the dominant elite. And that mixes in with what Wise was saying about, you know, the whole aspect of every man for himself and rugged individualism. This is all put out by the ruling class order. It's just a form of elite stratification, because all they're really talking to is the working class. They're not talking to a McDonald's and stuff, who, you know, is on corporate welfare and gets money through corporate welfare to advertise his chicken McNuggets across the world and stuff like that. When their friend Adolf was in trouble, they didn't hesitate to help him out, from Prescott Bush to, you know, Standard and on IBM. We've gone over the whole thing of Henry Ford in The Jews, that book, on one segment, a whole segment on that on a slave show. So we know that they don't talk, they didn't say, hey, Hitler, you got to be a rugged individual, you're on your own. Nah, the elite class protects itself when it sees itself. You know, they protect themselves from lawsuits. So this whole thing is basically a myth. You have all this corporate deregulation to protect these corporations and to protect individuals within the corporations, etc., etc. So, but when you see many people look through the world through these white lenses, you can see how they'll regurgitate that kind of rugged individualism claptrap talk out. So many of us have heard people say, well, black people are just too dependent. My grandfather came from Ireland or wherever, Italy, and he had nothing in his pocket, but he made, you know, a business for himself and yada, yada, you know, all that John Wayne type of stuff. This is just a game. And as the liberals play into it, which is really not playing into it from accident, because liberalism is a part of an elite hierarchical order within itself to maintain the privilege of the elite class. You can see how they would, of course, want to do the individual blame. Let's blame Boy George, or just the GOP, or Halliburton, instead of the way that the whole hierarchical system is set up, because they want to protect the whole hierarchical system, which is in part why you did not see Al Gore go after the whole apparatus and institution that allowed the Republican Party to steal the election in 2000, because he was more interested in protecting the whole system itself, as opposed to exposing the GOP and the system that all of them operate out of, even if that was at the expense of black vote. That's the way the game is played. Now, another aspect of how people's lens is distorted is when you have a situation of, if one looks how the masses of people have bought in to the construct of whiteness, which is a white elitist construct. So even if you're white working class, or, you know, some Ward Connolly type Negro, one can see how the vision of the world in a black people is this off kilter, because you're looking at the world not in reality, but in a parallel difference between as opposed to black people and black people's real experience. So let's take like from the 30s to like the 60s and stuff like that, or on and from there. White people's vision of the black community and black people were the proofs in the pudding by what was created by white people about the black experience and said about the black experience and so on and so forth. What was being put out by white people? And it's just modernized today. Well, Amos and Andy, Step and Fetch It, Buckwheat, Ancient Mama, you know, all that type of imagery and stuff that you saw or heard on TV from the 30s and on up to, you know, 60s and beyond. And the more, if you watch UPN, it's just modernized today. Now, what were black people, through black people's own experience, producing, though? Malcolm, John Coltrane, Lorraine Hansberry, James Baldwin, Martin Luther King. In other words, the complete opposite. Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, the complete opposite. Richard White, the complete opposite of the vision of white people, of black people, was being created by the people themselves. Now, of course, white people had to deal with the fact that these black people were there, and they often did deal with them and their organizations by counterintelligence program, assassinations, etc., etc., New Kill, so on and so forth. But my whole point is that you had a situation where through the lens of whiteness, you had white people have an image constructed of black people that was completely opposite of the real black experience. And the reason why it was so distorted was because of not just the ruling class order's perpetuation, but because the masses of people who found themselves digesting the concept of whiteness, their whole vision and view of black people and the black experience was off. So here you have someone, there's no way that if someone saw themselves as white and envisioned what black people were all about through that whiteness, could have ever imagined black people producing a Paul Robeson, you know, a multi-talented singer, athlete, intellect, or a John Coltrane, or a Malcolm. You know, there's just no way that they could have ever imagined someone as dynamic as a Nina Simone or James Baldwin, because it's so far removed from that concept of white people's vision, because of whiteness, of black people. So you have a dynamic that from that framework, though, it wasn't out of the vision of black people, because black people, of course, envisioned it, and black people were creating and are creating these types of dynamics and people and stuff, because in part, the black experience and the concept of blackness for black people is rooted in the construct of liberation, search of humanity, and equality. So it's coming from a completely different dynamic. One's coming out of an elitist concept and construct of control, and the other is coming out of a liberation and in search of humanity construct. Now, next, Tim Wise goes into the role of the Democrats in New Orleans in color. Check this out.
State level, we have the Democratic governor in the state of Louisiana, Kathleen Blanco. For the last 30-some-odd years, the state has had both Democrat and Republican governors, and none of them, irrespective of their party, irrespective of how much they claimed to identify, and perhaps in some ways as individuals did identify with working-class people, and yet at no point has Kathleen Blanco thought to stand up to the petrochemical industry, which in this state of Louisiana, which we've now been paying so much attention to, continues to belch roughly 132 million pounds of toxic chemicals into the air and into the water between Baton Rouge and New Orleans in what environmentalists refer to as Cancer Alley, an area known for extreme exposure to toxic chemicals coming from 140 approximately petrochemical plants that line the length of the Mississippi River between the capital of Baton Rouge and the city of New Orleans. That 132 million pounds of toxics is roughly 7 times the national average per square mile in the country as a whole, and it, of course, directly affects, most directly and most disproportionately, low-income communities of color, which are located along the river, and of course most of the pollution in the water flows downstream until it reaches the majority black city of New Orleans. Not only have Democrats and Republicans in Louisiana done nothing to stop or to significantly reduce the toxic emissions that are causing such disproportionate health problems, disproportionate cancer rates, disproportionate rates of birth defects in Cancer Alley, but more to the point, they have actually subsidized the poisoning of their people by way of various tax breaks and tax giveaways, again, whether the administration has been Democrat or Republican. So, for example, in the state of Louisiana, there is one particular program that is more egregious than maybe all the rest, called the Industrial Property Tax Exemption Program. And this is a program which exempts approximately and results in the loss of $200 million worth of property tax revenue every year for the parishes of Louisiana, as much as $300 million in certain years. This is property that is taken off the rolls, billions of dollars every decade, where those companies that receive exemptions on the property pay no taxes for an entire 10-year period. And as a result of that, schools in those parishes lose a significant amount of revenue, because a third of those taxes, had they been collected, would have gone to schools. But because those taxes are not collected, again, between $200 and $300 million a year in foregone tax revenue, the schools in some of the rural parishes, and certainly in the urban and industrial parishes as well, lose out on millions and millions of dollars. Now, those who support these kinds of tax giveaways have always talked about how they create jobs, but the fact of the matter is, and this has been studied by the Louisiana Coalition for Tax Justice, it's been studied by several other nonprofit organizations, 70% of the tax breaks that are given to these corporations in Louisiana create no new jobs whatsoever. 90% of the tax breaks are given to 50 companies, and among them are the wealthiest companies on the planet. Half of all the tax breaks have been given to just 9 companies in the state of Louisiana, and even when they do create jobs, generally the amount of money that's being lost to the cities and to the states and to the parishes comes out to about $100,000 for every job they actually create. So in other words, yes, occasionally jobs will be created, yes, occasionally payroll will be added, but the loss in tax revenue is considerably greater than the amount of money that the workers are going to be paid, which means it's actually a net loss for the parishes and for their school. And there were very few politicians in Louisiana, Democrat or Republican, who said anything about this. The reason I'm providing this kind of background is simply to suggest that every day is disaster day for low-income folks in Louisiana, as well as around the country, and Hurricane Katrina in that regard was not new. And we make a very big mistake if we reduce this to George W. Bush, if we reduce this only to Republicans. We must examine the way in which the political and economic system in which both Bush and Kathleen Blanco operate, and Mayor Ray Nagin of New Orleans operate, how that system is one that regularly prioritizes the needs of elites and does harm to the needs and the interests of low-income folks and people of color.
So once again, As we've often gone into on Slave, one can see, once again, how the Democrats and the Republicans are a construction of the elite order. And the elite ruling order constructed in part, one of the things they constructed as a part of their elite order is the construct of whiteness as a tool of economic, social, political control. So you see the subsidization aspect on the tax breaks and all of that other stuff. Now, we've gone into all of these various forms of subsidization of whiteness and transfer of monies and so on and so forth. So here you have the property tax. No taxes for 10 years for these corporations. Property taken off the role of out, so the schools lose out $200 to $300 million a year. So places like the Ninth Ward are left in a dilapidated state. This is intentional and stuff. So so we see how who subsidizes the elite order, which once again was created as a construction and constructed by whiteness as a tool for oppression. And you can see this in its clearness, that whiteness is an elitist concept and design, and it's a parasitic construct implemented to exploit its dark subjects within the market order. Because whiteness within itself is an artificial construct. It has real meaning and it has real impact, but it's a construct that was created as a tool by a ruling order to control the masses of people. So next, let's check out how, we've gone over this clown in Hurricane Sam 1 through 5, let's check what Tim Wise has to say about the Negro New Orleans mayor, Nagin. So check this out.
Now let's look at the local level, because one of the interesting ways in which the skeptics, those who don't believe that the incidents related to Katrina had anything to do with race, one of the ways in which they've made that argument to say that, well, it can't possibly be about race, because after all, the mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, is black, and therefore the neglect, the fact that folks were left behind, can't possibly be about that. What's interesting about this argument is one of the things that people don't understand is that politics in New Orleans is very racially divided. Mayor Ray Nagin was not elected because of the support of the African-American community in New Orleans. In fact, Ray Nagin did not even receive the majority of the black votes when he was elected mayor. He received less than half of the African-American vote in that city, but he got almost 90% of the white votes. He was the candidate of white, corporate, elite, and affluent, relatively speaking, white New Orleanians. He was a vice president of a cable company, the co-owner of a hockey team. He came out of the business world. He was the kind of guy that white conservatives liked because he would, quote-unquote, run the city like a business. And the irony here is that when this tragedy struck, and this is not to suggest Ray Nagin's personal feelings towards the African-American community, I do think it is worth pointing out the fact that Mayor Ray Nagin would not indeed respond quickly enough to the needs of the black community, just like the state under Kathleen Blanco did not, just like the national government under the leadership of Bush did not, really ought not shock anyone. This is a man whose political career was not made by or for the African-American community, particularly low-income folks in that city, and had always identified far more with the political and the economic elites in that city, so that when disaster strikes, he is thinking in that mode that business people think in, which is the every man for himself, every woman for himself mode. All I'm suggesting is that we have a political and economic and social system at all levels which does not allow even the best intended of mainstream politicians to prioritize the needs of low-income folks. So, in effect, we are talking about a local government which may be black-run, but does not represent the interest of the African-American community and ought not be assumed to just because there is a skin tone in common. Likewise, the local levy board, the New Orleans Levy Board, which is a bipartisan entity, Democrats and Republicans, white and black, and yet you have a levy board which, in the last couple of years, has diverted about $15 million worth of federal funding that was given for the purpose of helping to sustain and repair the levees, had diverted about $15 million worth of federal funds from that purpose to a totally different purpose. They diverted the funds so as to build two new overpasses, which would allow affluent, primarily tourists, to access the lakefront casinos more easily. Why would one do that? Obviously, it is not necessarily because the people on the levee board don't care about poor folks per se, or hate them or dislike them. It has to do with the fact that, once again, given the option of prioritizing the needs of working people, low-income persons, or prioritizing the needs of affluent tourists and a multi-billion-dollar gambling industry, what do you think is likely to be the choice of political and economic elites? And so whether we're talking about the federal level and its budget priorities, the state level and its budget priorities, the local level and its priorities, none of this is particularly surprising. It really is sort of business as usual.
So once again, one can see how, you know, in reality, whether it's a city is run by certain Negroes or whatever, this is a business society, and a business society is constructed by the ruling order. So it's going to follow basically the guidelines and outlines, including the whole construct of whiteness by that ruling order. In the same way, it doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or Republican, which Nagin happens to be a Democrat, but it doesn't matter because, once again, the society, the hierarchical society, is constructed by a ruling order. So those are the guidelines that they follow. You can see it in its intensified barbaric form play itself out by going to the website GretnaSucks.com. You know, Gretna's the little community where the cops were shooting over the head of many of the black people and anyone else who happened to be with the black people, trying to get over to Gretna, the city of Gretna, which wasn't really impacted by the Hurricane Sam events. Well, it was impacted by its racism and produced its own Hurricane Sam elements and stuff like that. So as Wise pointed out, Ray Nagin runs the city like a business. Right, that's what he does. And Ray Nagin is part of the business class, which is part of the privatized order, which is constructed, amongst many other things, around the concept and construct of whiteness. Now, as we started off the beginning of the show, you know, I blew up that Neil Bortz clown, you know, and didn't let him go on. Now I'm going to let him go on. And as one can see how the construct of whiteness and how race is played within the hierarchical construct, encoded in at times not so coded words, one can see what this silly right-wing radio show producer was really saying when he was saying his issues concerning rich versus poor being informed about a terrorist attack, as we tie this all together.
Okay, I got an insensitive thought, folks. There's a news story out there. There's a news story out there that rich people got some sort of an email notification of the terrorist threat against the New York subway before poor people did. Okay? They're making a big deal out of it. Let me see if I can find it on the Drudge report here. Let's see. There's a guy strangling a goose. That's a pretty impressive picture. It's something about bird flu. So he's got this goose and he's just wringing its neck. You can, let's see, email agency. Who tipped off the big shots? Okay, now here's the story, and it says the Homeland Security Department launched internal probes yesterday into whether its officials tipped off friends and relatives to a possible subway terror plot days before average New Yorkers were alerted. So the real gripe here is that it seems that some wealthy people got notified of the terror plot before the great unwashed, before the others. Now, the Daily News in New York has a headline: Rich got terror tip. Rich got terror tip. Okay, let's get logical about this, folks. Let's play logic with this. This is as it should be. Okay? If we are faced with disaster in this country, let me ask you this. Okay, you just be logical. Get all of the emotion out of this. Get all of the emotion out of this. But if we are faced with a disaster in this country, which group do we want to save? The rich or the poor? Now, if you have time, save as many people as you can. But if you have to set some priorities, where do you go? The rich or the poor? Okay? Who is a drag on society? The rich or the poor? Who provide the jobs out there? The rich or the poor? Which group fuels our economy? Drives industry? The rich or the poor? Now, if you, all of a sudden, somebody walks up to you and says, hey, sports listener, you have to make a choice. We're going to move you to another country. And you're just going to have to make your way in this other country. We have a choice of two countries for you. In this country, people achieve a lot and they are wealthy because of their hard work. In this country, people don't achieve squat. They sit around all the time waiting for somebody else to take care of them. They have children they can't afford. They're uneducated. They can barely read. And the high point of their day is Entertainment Tonight on TV. Which country do you want to live in? The country of the high achievers? Or the country of sheep? The country of followers? You know what you're going to do. I don't see what the big problem is.
So there it is. In all of this splendid hierarchical order construct. When you hear someone like this talk about rich or poor, who's a drag on society? Who drives the economy, fuels industry, and believes in this whole construct of what's taking place and this whole manifest destiny type of thing. And one knows, as we've been talking about, how the construction of whiteness and how it was invented to maintain this particular economic order that puts the masses of people in a situation where you would even have to consider under their, this is their view, even have to consider who to save, basically tells you of the hierarchical system and how it was constructed. And that also, through that white lens, plays itself out. Who are you going to save within a hierarchical system, white or black? Well, for the slaves, that basically means we need to get rid of this hierarchical system. And to save ourselves and those who are part of the elite construct, the slavers, they're the ones that need to be disposed of and their construct of whiteness. For in essence, the American dream is like a dreamscape that no civilized human really should want to be a part of. Because anyone who stays asleep in this American dream too long will be turned into a terrified, paranoid, confused drone, or slipped into a perpetual state of childlike Alice in Wonderland mentality, not fit to call oneself an adult or be prepared for adult or humanhood in today's world. We as the slaves have to create our own destiny outside of the order. Until the next time, slave out.